Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 20th, 2014. Rebel leader David Yao Yao returns to Juba with a message of peace.
We thank God very much for bringing us safely in the air until we arrive at Juba International Airport.
And only four donors, including European Union, pledge money at the Oslo Donors Conference to help critical humanitarian work in South Sudan.
Italy is deeply concerned by the dramatic escalation of violence in the country. We have immediately activated our mechanism of assistance, disbursing 1.25 million euros in humanitarian aid between the end of 2013 and the first part of this year.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Rebel leader David Yao Yao arrived in Juba today, marking the end of his rebellion against the government of South Sudan. Yao Yao says his agreement with the government shows conflicts in South Sudan can be resolved through peaceful dialogue. As Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba, Yao Yao says he is ready to help resolve the ongoing conflict between President Kiir's forces and those allied to former Vice President Riek Machar.
Yao Yao arrived in Juba aboard a United Nations plane amidst tight security and was immediately driven to a hotel. He told reporters he is happy to be back in Juba.
We thank God very much for bringing us safely in the air until we arrive at Juba International Airport.
Akot Lual, an advisor to President Kiir, welcomed Yao Yao to Juba.
It is a great day for all of us, and from here we have to put our hand together and solve other problems like what we have done in before.
Yao Yao says the government agreed to some of his demands.
We have already finalized everything, so Bibo now is not a mere Bibo like before. It become a greater Bibo, which is a great achievement in us, especially the four communities who are given the responsibility of this greater Bibo.
But Bishop Emeritus of the Catholic Diocese of Torit, Paride Taban, who was the lead mediator in the government talks with Yao Yao's group, says more fighting is not the answer.
We would like to see that now the South Sudan Cobra movement and army should work more for peace rather than for violence and war.
Presidential advisor Lual says military officials from both sides will work to reintegrate Yao Yao's forces into the SPLA. Up to 6,000 largely Murle youth are believed to have joined Yao Yao's rebellion. And hundreds of Jonglei-based soldiers and police of Murle ethnicity are thought to have defected to Yao Yao's side at the height of the rebellion. Christian Manal, political counselor of the European Union's delegation to South Sudan, welcomed the end of Yao Yao's rebellion.
We have supported this process and we will also support any measure that can help implement it properly and to stabilize the peace in this area. We are of course concerned about the bigger conflict that is ongoing and that the peace that has now been achieved with this agreement will expand to cover the whole of South Sudan.
Yao Yao first rebelled against Juba after he failed to win a parliamentary seat in the 2010 general elections, accusing the ruling SPLM party of rigging the elections. In 2011, he accepted an amnesty offer from President Kiir and returned to Juba, where he was promoted to the rank of SPLA general. But a year later, he fled to Khartoum and began his rebellion against the government in his home county of Pibor in Jonglei State. Yao Yao's rebels were accused of being behind violent cattle raids that left hundreds of civilians dead. Most of them were women and children. The rebels were also accused of killing five Indian peacekeepers in Jonglei State last year. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
7 people have died of suspected cholera cases in Upper Nile State. Medical charity group Mid-Air says 27 patients who visited their facility in Kaka village along the River Nile have symptoms of cholera. Dr. Trina Hildeman says the number of cases in Juba is also increasing every day.
We have had 188 cases that have come to Juba Teaching Hospital. So far, of those, only three have died. And there were also an additional six cases out in the community, which were treated at a private facility. So that brings the total to 194 cases, I believe.
And are we only talking about Juba, or there are other areas where you are also getting reports of cholera cases?
Right now, the only place where cholera has been confirmed is in Juba. However, we have several areas where there are suspected cases, and investigation is ongoing. Most of those areas are along the Nile River in Jonglei State and in Upper Nile State. There are about six different locations. Some of them we just heard about today. Actually, I just came from a meeting where they were discussing. So the Ministry of Health will be sending out teams to investigate and also to collect samples from those patients to determine if it's cholera or not.
Any cases of people who might have died in those areas that you're talking about?
Yes, there are some reports of deaths in those areas. I think in one of the locations there were 28 cases and 7 deaths.
Which location is that?
That is in Kaka, which is in Upper Nile State.
How many agencies are responding to this outbreak?
Right now there are 3 international NGOs, MSF, MedAir, and IMA is helping with the investigation in Kaka. But then you also have the UN agencies who are assisting WHO and UNICEF.
I know there are other partners who are already raising an alarm about the situation in South Sudan. Would you categorize it as an outbreak?
Yes, this is definitely considered an outbreak. With cholera, it's actually only one case is required to confirm an outbreak because of the infectivity of the cholera, the ease of transmission from one person to another. So if you have one case, then you should expect that more cases will come.
With the security situation in the country, how do you foresee this situation going on from today?
I think the biggest complication that the security situation poses is that there's currently emergency responses that are taking place all across the country due to displaced persons, due to other outbreaks that have been created because of displaced persons like measles. And so most of the partners are quite busy already responding to different emergencies across the country. And so it leaves us with not a lot of human resources left to be able to respond to the cholera. So I think that's probably the biggest challenge, is that we don't have a lot of extra in-country surge capacity to be able to scale up and respond.
Dr. Trina Hildeman is with the medical charity MedAir. She was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. International donors have pledged more than $600 million to assist South Sudan during a conference today in Norway. The United States contributed $291 million. United Nations officials say they still need to raise more than $500 million to meet the country's needs over the next 6 to 9 months. Philip Aleu has the story for VOA from Oslo.
U.S. Assistant Secretary for African Affairs Linda Somers-Greenfield says her government is concerned about reports that fighting continues in parts of South Sudan. But she says officials realize they must do something now to help the millions of displaced people across the country who are in need.
It's not to the country, it's for the people that we are providing assistance to deal with what is a very, very worrisome humanitarian situation that's looming. And we feel that the people of South Sudan deserve this. They will be reached, and that's what the humanitarian agencies are there for. That's what the UN is doing. That's what the non-governmental organizations are doing. And we're working through those organizations to reach the people.
United Nations officials say the money will be used to deliver food and other emergency aid this year and to preposition supplies during the first 3 months of next year. The UN estimates 4 million people face alarming food insecurity and 7 million are at risk. Mario Valdi, the head of humanitarian aid for Italy, says his country remains committed to assisting South Sudan in its time of need.
Italy is deeply concerned by the dramatic escalation of violence in the country and by the potential spillover effect in the region. Coherently with our long-standing commitment in the area, we have immediately activated our mechanism of assistance, disbursing 1.25 million euros in humanitarian aid between the end of 2013 and the first part of this year. We will continue to remain committed.
Donations have even arrived from unexpected places like Khartoum. Sudan Foreign Affairs Minister Ali Ahmed Kati says they decided to donate 10,000 tons of sorghum for the South Sudan government to deliver to the people most in need.
I'm sure they will resolve the problem, the political one, and peace will come again. South Sudan is neighbored by Sudan, is neighbored by so many who would like South Sudan to come back again. I feel everything will go forward in a peaceful way.
Valerie Amos, the UN Undersecretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator, says officials were pleased with the results of the two-day conference.
The outcome has surpassed our expectations. We need those pledges to turn immediately into commitments because the work on the ground needs to be done now. And we need the interest in South Sudan to be sustained. We don't want to see a repeat of this next year.
Amos says the UN will continue to appeal for additional funds to meet the current shortfall. For BOA News, I am Philip Thornalew in Oslo, Norway.
The Norwegian Foreign Ministry says more than 50 countries, large, small, attended the conference in Oslo. They listened to speeches from dignitaries, including the UN humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, and South Sudan's Foreign Minister, Barnaba Marial Benjamin. And then they made their pledges, large and small, to help.
As the White House announced yesterday, the United States is almost doubling our humanitarian assistance with a new contribution of $291 million to meet the urgent needs.
Estonia has decided to alleviate the situation by contributing 200,000 euros through the United Nations agencies.
I am here to pledge on behalf of the Egyptian government further assistance reaching $2 million.
On behalf of the United Kingdom government, I am able to announce a new commitment of £60 million, equivalent to around $100 million for the response within South Sudan.
The bulk of the pledges came from just four donors: the United States, the European Union, the United Kingdom, and Norway. But by the end of the day, funds pledged for South Sudan had doubled from $600 million to around $1.2 billion. The head of the United Nations Population Fund is appealing to donors in Oslo to pledge $25 million to make certain that life-saving reproductive health care and gender-based violence services are put in place across South Sudan to help women and girls survive. He says 30,000 South Sudanese women are at risk of dying at childbirth, and the risk has been magnified by the crisis. Carol Van Dam has this report for VOA.
Dr. Babatunde Ashatame says in times of crisis, women and girls are the least protected.
And we see that in war, there is a spike of violence against women and girls. There's also a sense that they can be pushed around, and that's what happened. We also know that given their own particular circumstances, they require special attention. The dignity of women, we have to look after.
A cholera outbreak in South Sudan has left thousands of pregnant women even more at risk, he says. And Dr. Babatunde stresses that it's important to remember that civilians, especially women and children, had nothing to do with the argument between President Kiir and Riek Machar, which led to all the bloodshed.
The people who are suffering are not the ones who are fighting. They're the people who have just been displaced. They're the people who have been marginalized. They're the people who have been sent out of their homes.
And that's where the UN Population Fund comes into play.
Right now, we're meeting some of it, but there's a gap. And we believe that if we can, we'll be able to step up to provide access to antenatal and perinatal and postnatal care for women, for lactating mothers, making sure that we provide girls with dignity kits to protect them.
With all the suffering women and children are going through, I asked Dr. Babatunde if donors are upset that representatives of President Kiir and Machar are also at the Oslo conference wanting to have a say in how the donor money is spent.
it's upsetting. But given what we have, and given the fact that we need to look after this humanitarian, acute humanitarian situation, we need to, A, try and secure peace, because I think that's the most important. And then, of course, you know, make sure that we can respond to the needs of people who are on the ground.
Dr. Babatunde describes what he hopes to achieve in South Sudan with the help of the Donors Conference.
What we want and what we aspire for as the United Nations is to build a credible mechanism that enables us to reach out to every man, every woman, every child, and every little girl who requires our assistance to be able to have a life of dignity.
Carol Van Dam, VOA News, Washington.
The leader of the National Umma Party in Sudan are calling for the release of chief of the party, Sadiq al-Mahdi. Al-Mahdi has been in jail since he was arrested by security forces at his home in Omdurman on Saturday. The former prime minister, who was overthrown by Omar al-Bashir in 1989, has accused government-recruited forces of rape, looting, and other crimes against civilians in Darfur and southern Kordofan. From Washington, VOA fellow Nabil Biagio has this report.
Maryam al-Sadiq is the daughter of Sadiq al-Mahdi and a leading figure in the Umma Party. She notes that charges of abuses and crimes in Darfur and South Kordofan are nothing new and have been documented by international human rights groups. She says her father's arrest is retaliation.
His arrest is political, and there is no criminal accusation against him because he mentioned something that everybody knows.
Al-Mahdi sent a statement from Kobar prison on Sunday directing his party to immediately suspend its engagement in the dialogue President Omar al-Bashir has been promoting recently.
We immediately stopped the participation in the dialogue called for by the ruling party. Because of the absolute lack of any margin of freedom of expression.
Al-Sadiq says the Umma Party had accepted President Bashir's call for dialogue on condition that political freedom must be guaranteed. She says arresting the head of the Umma Party is a clear violation of that condition.
We are organizing a meeting this Friday for all the heads of the Umma Party in the state to synchronize our move in popular protest all over Sudan and outside Sudan.
Al-Sadiq says if al-Mahdi is found guilty, he could face the death penalty.
He was accused by the National Assembly, the so-called the parliament of the NCP, with highest treason.
Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal confirms that the allegations against al-Mahdi are very serious, although he isn't sure what the penalty is. Bilal says nobody is allowed to question the conduct of the army or they face arrest.
Nobody is to talk about the army actions and these things, and they know this, and this is what caused a red line.
The Rapid Support Forces are commonly believed to be the Janjaweed militia who are accused of crimes against humanity in Darfur. Bilal insists that is not true. He says the Rapid Support Forces have been recruited to fight rebel groups in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile.
The Rapid Forces are not actually a different, they are not militia. They are part of the army with certain missions.
The Rapid Support Forces were reportedly deployed around Khartoum on Sunday in a state of readiness. No explanation was provided by the government for the action. Meanwhile, the Umma Party is calling for protests around Sudan on Friday. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The beginning of the rainy season raises the risk of cholera and dysentery. These are infections of the intestine that cause cramps, severe diarrhea, dehydration, and sometimes even death. The diseases can be spread when floodwaters carry human waste. And even after the rain ends, the tiny organisms that cause the diseases can continue to live on in stagnant pools of water. That's why it's so important for you and your family not to eat contaminated food or drink bad water. Only drink bottled water or water that's been boiled or purified. Peel raw fruits and vegetables before eating them, or even better, cook them for at least 5 minutes and eat them while they're still hot. Finally, Make sure you wash your hands with soap and water before eating. Taking these steps will help you and your family avoid serious disease.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the theme for this year's largest conference on HIV/AIDS. Find out what it is when we come back.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on the events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We're also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That is South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you ever voted in your country's elections, and why or why not?
I voted because I've always believed that through the vote, we can transform a nation.
I have voted since 1992 because I've always wanted to have good leaders who can lead this country well. That was one reason. Again, it's also my constitutional right to vote. I wanted to, you know, be one Kenyan, be a Kenyan by voting.
Nope, and I don't think I will ever vote. Things will just be the same. So long as you have money, you can get anyone to do whatever you want, including people voting for you. And if it's not voting for you in the right manner, stealing the election.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment. The world's largest gathering on HIV/AIDS will be held in July in Melbourne, Australia. The theme of the 20th International AIDS Conference, also known as AIDS 2014, is Nobody Left Behind. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports organizers have issued the Melbourne Declaration.
Since the AIDS conference in Durban, South Africa in 2000, conference organizers have released declarations several months prior to the event. Chris Byrer is a professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and president-elect of the International AIDS Society. He says there are several reasons why declarations are issued.
Certainly the first is, as in the case with the Durban Declaration, that there are often compelling issues facing the field and facing everyone living with HIV and people working on HIV that really demand international attention. So the conference provides a platform, a spotlight on the global epidemic, and so we use the conference declarations to really highlight those issues.
The Melbourne Declaration affirms that non-discrimination is fundamental to an evidence-based, rights-based, and gender-transformative response to HIV and effective public health programs.
There has been a wave of new anti-gay discriminatory laws and policies in a number of countries. The recent laws in Russia, the new laws that were passed in Nigeria in 2013 and in Uganda just recently, which really are a threat to access to care for people living with HIV and for sexual and gender minorities more broadly.
AIDS 2014 organizers say such laws exist in over 80 countries.
The motivation for this current declaration is really to say the HIV response has always been about universal access, about non-discrimination, and about working with affected people and communities. That's always been who we are, and that's why we've had the successes that we've had. And so we're really trying to use the conference to highlight that we see these laws as really a dangerous trend in the wrong direction.
Many of the laws against gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders have their roots in colonialism. But Byrer says the new law in Nigeria takes discrimination further.
It was not illegal, for example, to organize meetings, to have discussions, to do outreach for folks at risk, for gay and other men who have sex with men. The new law criminalizes all those behaviors. So, for example, makes it illegal to organize a public health meeting to discuss these issues. It makes it illegal to do outreach and provide services.
The effect, he says, is to quickly cut off access to life-saving HIV services.
Untreated HIV is still fatal. So when you talk about reducing people's access to care, this is not trivial. This is a life or death matter.
While the U.S., Great Britain, and others have moved toward expanding gay rights, including same-sex marriage, some former British colonies are going in the opposite direction. Some of the anti-gay laws have the support of American evangelical groups. One minister, Scott Lively, has been active in Uganda and Russia, for example. He's currently being sued in Massachusetts by an American group representing sexual minorities in Uganda. The suit accuses Lively of crimes against humanity. Lively's attorney says his client's preaching against homosexuality is protected by the U.S. Constitution. In 2016, the International AIDS Conference returns to Durban, South Africa. It was the first time the meeting was held in a developing country, and the last time it was in Africa. At the time, organizers issued the Durban Declaration, which said HIV caused AIDS. It was aimed at then-South African President Thabo Mbeki, who had refused to accept that a virus was the cause of the epidemic. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. China has summoned the U.S. ambassador after Washington charged five Chinese military officers with conducting economic espionage against American companies. The official Xinhua news agency said today that China's foreign ministry lodged a solemn representation to Ambassador Max Baucus. Thailand's military has declared martial law, saying it did so to keep peace and order after months of sometimes violent anti-government protests. In a televised announcement today, General Prayuth Chan-o-cha defended the move as necessary to resolve the country's political crisis. The army, which has staged 11 coups in the last 80 years, denies it's taking over. And finally, a South African court has ruled that Olympic runner Oscar Pistorius must be admitted as an outpatient at a psychiatric hospital for mental observation. The prosecution persuaded the court to have him referred to psychiatrists to establish if he was mentally responsible when he shot and killed his girlfriend. And that's a look at some of today's top news stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's all we had for you this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Walma by Abye Jazz Band. Been listening to Abye Jazz Band with that song Walma. I'm your host John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening, and we are grateful for your company. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
chaga wanu chiki.